only about the plane, the wind, and the shore, so far away where land begins again. If she dies, though, she wants some version of the story to persist, fragmented and incomplete as it may be, even if the chances of anyone ever finding it are vanishingly small. We've fixed the leak as best we can. She hesitates, then finally writes an I, not a we. I will go soon. Probably the ice will calve and carry little America out to sea and her logbook with it. What I have done is foolish. I had no choice but to do it. Probably the snow will bury it too deeply to ever be found. No one should ever read this. My life is my one possession. Probably. And yet. She closes the book, wraps it in Eddie's life preserver, leaves it in the bunk room of Little America 3. Until she dies, she will wonder if she could have persuaded him to come with her. Until she dies, she will remember Eddie's small, dark figure on the ice, waving to her with both arms as she circles up. She will always be afraid that his valedictory gesture might have changed at some moment when she was too far away to notice into a plea for her to return.
Sitting in the Water Grizzly. 20. I knocked on the door of the blue house. Joey Kamaka opened it and burst out laughing. He laughed so hard he bent over with his hands on his thighs. "It's really you," he said when he'd recovered. "I thought for sure someone was messing with me." He was wiry and barefoot, around 60, in board shorts and a t-shirt, with a short gray ponytail. A small girl, maybe 8, also ponytailed, had her arms locked around his waist from behind and was peeping at me with giant cartoon bunny rabbit eyes. "This is my granddaughter, Kehlani," he said. "She's only seen the first Archangel movie because the others got too scary. But she has all the Katie McGee DVDs. She loves Katie McGee." He waved me inside, and I stepped out of my flip-flops, added them to a pile by the door. The house was small but bright, with walls and ceilings of white-painted planks and beat-up dark ones for the floor. It was the first time I'd been in a room I knew Marion Graves had been in, too. Everywhere else had been sets and stand-ins. There was a toy-strewn living room with a braided rug and a sagging couch facing a big flat-screen TV. And through one door, I glimpsed a bathroom, and through another, a chaotic den of pink and purple, presumably Kehlani's room. Stairs led up through an open hatch, and a landscape painting hung slightly crooked on the wall, sharply angled mountains dense with trees and shadows. I moved to get a closer look. "Is this?" I asked.
"It's by Jamie Graves," Joey said. "Kayla brought it with him from the mainland. I know it's worth a lot, and I should sell it or at least get a security system or something, but it's just kind of always been there. I still feel like it's Caleb's and not mine."
The night before, in a bigger, nicer version of this house some location scout had found, I'd filmed a scene where Marion and Eddie were staying with Caleb, and there's a storm in the night, and Marion betrays Eddie by going to Caleb, and they fuck while Eddie's pretending to be asleep in the room below. So, actor Caleb and I, wearing little flesh-colored patches on our crotches, had feigned hot passion while a bunch of people stood around holding booms and reflectors, and the intimacy coordinator said things like, "Hadley, would you be comfortable if he had his hands on your waist instead of your hips?" Bart had started to make noises about maybe the scene would be better, more authentic, if it showed my breasts, and I'd expected myself to say yes because that's what I've always done,
but instead I said, "No one needs to see Marion's tits, Bart." And that was the end of it. Thank God I hadn't read Adelaide Scott's box of letters till we were almost done shooting. Because now I had to act on two levels. One, like Marion, in a way that was consistent with everything else we'd shot. And two, like I didn't know what I now knew, which was that Eddie had been gay and Marion had been in love with his wife. In Adelaide's living room, I'd first set the letters out on the floor like a huge puzzle. And then I read late into the night, fell asleep on her couch. Some had been to Marion, some from her. It seems an awful snare. I've told him I can scarcely imagine ever having one, and absolutely not anytime soon. And I thought he understood, but no, he does understand. It's that he doesn't care. He wants me snared. Please keep writing, even if my replies are as anemic as this one. I'm not myself right now. The doctor says I am doing well, and I haven't had a drink in a month. I know that counts for little, but I hope my small success is more than nothing. I know you and Caleb had history, but I guess you did miss men, after all. I am writing because it has come to my attention that my late husband, Lloyd Pfeiffer, allowed your father to suffer a great wrong. Joey led me into a compact kitchen with plywood cabinets and an old beige refrigerator. "I'm just finishing making Kehlani's lunch," he said, "and then we can talk. Can I get you anything?" He bent into the fridge. "Water, fruit punch, milk, beer?" "I love day beers," I said. It wasn't really a joke, but he laughed as he handed me a can, cracked one for himself. His laugh seemed to be always bubbling just under the surface. Kehlani's lunch was a compartmentalized plastic plate containing a sandwich cut into triangles, some baby carrots, and a dollop of something purple. Joey gave it to her and led me outside. The lanai had rattan furniture, with faded cushions printed with big green leaves. A ceiling fan turned languidly overhead. Their small and scrubby yard was bounded by a chain-link fence grown over with some kind of vine, and a pink bike with white tires lay on its side beside a child's playhouse in bleached pink plastic. In the corner, a wetsuit was draped over a hibiscus shrub. Beyond was a black rock shore, low, foamy waves, an immensity of water. "My wife, by the way, was so sure I was getting pranked that she went to Costco. She said she didn't want to witness my humiliation." Joey chuckled, a sort of rumbling warning tremor before an eruption, and plopped onto a love seat. "I hope she makes it back in time to meet you, or she'll never believe me." Kehlani stood in the doorway, clutching her plate in two hands, still ogling me with mingled covetousness and fear, like she was Indiana Jones and I was a legendary, potentially cursed artifact. Joey patted the cushion next to him. "Kehlani, come sit here by Granddad. Hadley doesn't bite." "To me," he said, "not a lot of movie stars drop by." I gave Kehlani a little finger wave, and she bolted back into the house, a rain of baby carrots falling behind her. Joey nearly collapsed with mirth. "Oh, man," he said eventually. "You know, that's probably the right response to meeting your heroes. Just run away."
"She lives with you?"
"For now."
His expression turned somber.
"Her parents have been having some issues."
"Sorry."
"That's life. But, so, you're in a movie about Marion Graves." Nah, Caleb never got married, Joey said. He wasn't really the type. He had some nice girlfriends, though. He was dating this hippie girl, Cheryl, for a while, who was friends with my mom. And so when I was a sophomore in high school, and my mom ran off with a guy to Arizona, and I started getting in trouble, this was in like 70, 71, Caleb and Cheryl took me in and straightened me out. They broke up after a couple years, and Cheryl left, but I stayed. I'd never really had a dad, so Caleb and I had our rocky patches, but we were always like this little team, you know? I didn't leave until I got married. Then, when Caleb got sick, my wife and I and our kids moved back in with him to help out. Not like I could ever repay him. He pointed at the ocean. I scattered his ashes just right there.
You must miss him, I said.
Yeah, sometimes, even though it's been 21 years. You don't really get it before it happens, how you always miss some people, you know?
I thought of Mitch. I do know. He looked at me curiously.
So Adelaide Scott told you about her, connection to Jamie Graves.
I nodded. She said she came here once.
Yeah, a long time ago. She was on a big family discovery kick. She was trying to figure some stuff out for sure.
Like what?
What you'd expect, I guess. Who am I? What should I do with my life? I was pretty young and not great at asking people, like, probing questions, so I didn't really interrogate her. Plus, I had a huge crush because she was really hot and scary. She seemed like such a grown-up, but she would only have been in her 20s, I think. She's made a big success of herself, right? She's some big artist. It was Caleb she kept in touch with more, not me. What did we really have in common, you know?
I couldn't think of what to ask. I sipped from my beer to cover my awkwardness. Reading those letters at Adelaide's had felt good, exciting and revelatory, almost like desire. I guess it was desire. I wanted to know more. But now the truth about Marion seemed too big, too amorphous for me to gather. She had spread out like debris from a wreck, drifting bits and pieces that didn't connect. Joey didn't seem to notice how lost for words I was. He said,
Caleb was the best, though. Like, he could be strict, and he wasn't the kind of guy to pretend he was in a good mood when he wasn't. But he was, you know, honorable. You could trust him. He partied a little too much sometimes, maybe. But I think he was like, I survived the war, so fuck it. He worked on a ranch until he got too old, and then he worked in a little library down the road. He liked to read. He didn't talk much about the war, but he said it had gotten him into books. When he got sick, he'd sit out here all day, reading. Then he got too sick to read, so he'd just hold a book in his lap and look at the ocean. He wasn't a spring chicken even back when he took me in. He must have been about the same age then that I am now.
He looked into the house, in the direction Kaylani had gone.
Life is full of surprises, though.
Did he talk much about Marion Graves?
You know, honestly, he wasn't, like, chatty. He didn't really share. But she came up sometimes, yeah. He said she was really brave and a really good pilot. I watched a TV show about her once, and I tried to read her book, but I couldn't get into it. I'm not really a reader. Caleb was always trying to get me to read. So Marion left her personal stuff to Adelaide Scott. But she left her money, there wasn't much, to Caleb. And then he got royalties from her book after they found it at the South Pole or whatever. That money added up. I didn't even know how much until after he died. There was all this money in his will, and I was like, where did this come from? The lawyers told me it was the book, which I guess really had a moment back in the day. It came in handy because my son wanted to go to college on the mainland, and now we have Kehlani.
Did Caleb say if he and Marion were ever involved? I said. Romantically? Thoughtful, he puffed out his cheeks and stared up at the ceiling fan.
I don't think so, but I wouldn't be surprised. Why? Were they?
I explained about Adelaide's letters. There hadn't been many from Caleb. Certainly not love letters. But I knew he'd gone to see her in Alaska, and Ruth's letter suggested a man had come between them. Carol Pfeiffer had given Marion and Caleb a romance, and the Day brothers had run with it, but it seemed more like conjecture than anything. While I was talking, Kehlani crept out and climbed up next to Joey without looking at me. She was fiddling with a plastic mermaid doll.
No kidding,
Joey said when I was done. A chuckle worked its way up from his belly.
That old dog. You know, thinking about him, he never seemed to be looking for, like, a partner. He had these relationships that went on for a year or two and were sort of casual, but also sort of intense. And then they'd fall apart. He'd be alone for a while, and then he'd find a new woman when he felt like it. Almost to the end, he had girlfriends. They'd come and hang out and cook him dinner. So maybe this thing with Marion was more of the same. Like, if their paths crossed, then great. They'd pick up where they left off.
He pulled Kehlani into his lap, said,
or maybe she was the big one. Maybe he never settled down with anyone because he didn't want to replace her.
Seems crazy to carry a torch for someone who's been dead for decades.
I just mean maybe he didn't stop missing her. But I did always wonder why he never settled down.
You never asked him why?
Nah, he would have just made some joke. I wish I could tell you more. I saved some of Caleb's stuff, though, if you want to see it. I got it out after you emailed.
Setting Kehlani on her feet, he got up and went inside, followed by the child, and came back out with an open cardboard box. The top layer of Joey's box was a mess of photos in no particular order. I took them out one by one, making a stack. Sitting beside me, he pointed to a black-and-white photo of a dark-haired, vaguely Asian-looking man in an army uniform sitting on a stone wall.
That's Caleb, he said.
I turned the photo over. Sicily was penciled on the back.
Go play, Kehlani,
Joey said, nudging the girl toward the yard, where she darted into the plastic playhouse like a gopher into a hole. There were color photos, some faded. Caleb on a horse, his hat ringed with fuchsia flowers. Caleb with a woman at the beach, with another woman at what looked like a wedding reception, sitting with a third woman on a cement structure on a hillside, their legs dangling.
That's Cheryl, who I talked about,
Joey said, pointing. She had long, wavy blonde hair.
That's a pillbox lookout station from the war. It's still there.
Caleb riding a horse up to its chest in the ocean. An ancient black and white studio photo of a pale girl with dark, tucked up hair in a tarnished silver frame. She wore a dress with a lace collar, and the image was ghostly and washed out with age.
I think that was his mother,
Joey said.
All he ever said about her was that she was a drunk and had bad luck.
Three children sitting unsmiling on a fence, all in overalls. Caleb with Marion and Jamie Graves. Nothing on the back. Teenage Joey grinning in a striped t-shirt, tending something on a smoking barbecue while Caleb looked on, holding a beer. Another black and white photo of Caleb in uniform, cigarette in one hand, leaning back in a leather booth. Cocktail glasses glinted in the flash. Marion Graves, in her blue ATA uniform, was beside him, looking away. On the back, London, 1944. Under the photos was a bundle of letters, tied neatly together with a shoelace. Joey reached for them, embarrassed.
Those are from me. When Hanako and I did a road trip on the mainland, we were only gone for a month, but I wrote him every day.
Under the letters was a paper folder, soft with age. Inside were press clippings about Marion's flight, from both before and after she went missing, haphazardly folded.
Caleb collected those, Joey said. I was surprised when I found them. Usually, he wasn't into saving things.
I started unfolding the brittle paper. I think sometimes people hope if they amass enough scraps, eventually the whole picture will become clear.
Is that what you're trying to do?
I don't know what I'm trying to do, I said. The same photo appeared again and again in the newspapers. Marion and Eddie standing beside the Peregrine before they left Auckland, smiling, almost bashful, both with their arms folded across their chests. Later, after the reporters had dug around in Marion's past, they ran the old photo of Addison Graves carrying the twins down the gangway of the SS Manaus. There was one of Marion in her ATA uniform, climbing into a Spitfire. And there was her wedding photo, next to some fluff piece about her colorful life. I closed the folder. Underneath it, in the box, was a certificate of appreciation from the library where Caleb had worked, and a program from his memorial service. Then came a magazine with a slip of paper marking an article about the ranch that included the photo of Caleb riding in the ocean. At the very bottom of the box was a white envelope addressed to Caleb and bearing several foreign stamps. The return address was a post office box in New Zealand. Mind if I...
Sure,
he said.
I've never been able to make any sense of it. For some reason, it was in the lockbox where he kept his birth certificate and important stuff like that. I don't even know why I kept it.
It was just a little bit of paper, another yellowed newspaper clipping, folded up small. I peeled its layers apart, pressed it flat. Bits flaked off around the edges. It was a photo from a newspaper called the Queenstown Courier, April 28, 1954. Four men in hats sat and sprawled on a grassy rise, each holding a beer bottle. In the background, sheep grazed. High country shepherds enjoying well-earned refreshment after the muster, read the caption. In black pen, someone had drawn an arrow to one of the men and written something in the margin. The handwriting was nearly illegible, but the specific style of its illegibility was so familiar my insides fizzed like I'd swallowed a sparkler. I squinted at the words. Sitting in the water, grizzly. When I set it down, the paper lifted up and curled slowly closed along its fold lines as though alive. I smoothed it out again. Sitting in the water grizzly, I said to Joey. Does that mean anything to you?
No clue,
he said. I looked it up on the internet once, and all I got was some stuff about an Indian woman who lived as a man. I don't really remember specifics.
The man under the arrow was reclining on one elbow with his long, thin legs stretched out, his face angled away from the camera and hidden by the shadow of his hat. I didn't know if I should tell Joey anything, but I couldn't help it. I took out my phone and zoomed in on a photo I'd taken of one of the letters Marion had written to Ruth. I turned it so Marion's rows of crabbed and spiky words lined up with the scribbled note. Check this out, I said. Joey came around to stand behind me, leaned down to study my phone.
What is it?
It's a letter Marion Graves wrote.
No way,
he said, getting it.
No way!
It's the same handwriting, right? I said. I'm not imagining things.
It really looks like it.
Did he get any more letters from New Zealand? Do you know?
Man, he went there. He went a bunch of times. I didn't mention it before because I thought he just liked New Zealand. People get really into that place.
Joey flopped back onto the love seat, his hands gripping the top of his head.
No way, he said again.
The sparks in my gut spread outward. I felt like my skeleton should be visible, glowing through my skin. When did he go there?
I don't remember specific dates or anything, but he'd kind of usually go after breakups. Not after all of them, but like maybe every 5 years or so. I know he'd been a couple of times before I moved in. He never took anyone with him. He said it was his thing he liked to do alone. And yeah, he got other letters too, but he didn't keep them. I think he might have actually burned them. I remember seeing bits in the coffee can he used as an ashtray and thinking it was sort of dramatic. It's not like he burned all the mail.
Did you ever ask him who was writing to him or why he kept going?
He just said he had a buddy from the war down there.
Do you remember anything else? Did he bring back photos?
No, no photos. Let me think for a second, though.
He closed his eyes. I waited. The sun was white on the ocean. Kehlani peeped at me from the playhouse window, retreated when she saw me looking back. Finally, Joey opened his eyes and shook his head.
No, sorry. Nothing else is coming to mind. I went through all his stuff when he died, and you've seen pretty much everything I saved. That was more than 20 years ago, anyway.
Do you really think he might have been going to see her?
What did I have? A photo of a faceless shepherd from 60 years ago. A scribbled reference to, maybe, a native person who might never have existed. I will go soon, Marion had written at the end of her logbook. I'd never thought about how it was an I and not a we. What about Eddie? What about the plane? How could Marion have made it to New Zealand without anyone knowing? Was it even possible to pass as a man? What about Adelaide Scott? If Marion had survived, she'd chosen never to see her niece again.
I don't know what to think, I said.
The breeze in the palm trees and the sound of the waves gave the quiet a shifting, velvety texture.
What will you do?
Joey said. What do you think I should do?
I don't know, man. Say you get out there and start telling people you have this crazy theory she survived. And then what? If you're right, and she did, she clearly didn't want anyone to know. If you're wrong, you look like a kook or like you just want attention or whatever. I guess my first impulse would be to let sleeping dogs lie.
Kaylani burst from the playhouse, running to greet a small, gray-haired woman in a big sun hat who was carrying a huge plastic bin of pretzels under one arm and a huge box of frozen waffles under the other. "Joey," she called. "Can you help unload, please?"
"Okay," he called back. "But you'll have to entertain our guest."
She looked up and spotted me. Her mouth opened in shock, and I could see how truly and totally she had not believed I would be on her porch. But here I was. Joey fell apart with laughter.
The flight. Our flight is in defiance of the sun and its daily traverse. "Come west," the sun says. It tugs at us, runs off like a child trying to entice us to follow. But we must go north, leaving the light behind. Marion Graves. Little America 3, Ross Ice Shelf, to Campbell Island. 78 degrees, 28 minutes south, 163 degrees, 51 minutes west, to 52 degrees, 34 minutes south, 169 degrees, 14 minutes east. March 4th, 1950. 21,785 nautical miles flown. The worst of her agony for the first hours is that she thinks she will reach New Zealand. The day is blue and mostly clear. Eddie had given her charts he'd already marked up with bearings and angles for the sextant. He had hugged her tight and kissed her hard on the cheek, shaken her hand, sent her off to what he at least claimed to believe would be her death. He had made her promise not to send anyone for him in the unlikely event of her reaching land. He said there would be no point, that she should tell people he had fallen in a crevasse. She thinks of him lying in the snow on a clear night, waiting to die. She thinks of Barclay almost giving himself to the snow the night they met, of Caleb lost in the snowstorm as a boy. They had both almost surrendered themselves to the cold, but had changed their minds. She finds herself hoping that Eddie will not change his, that the stars and the aurora will beckon him. Maybe she had left the logbook behind in order to abandon the truth along with Eddie. She is past the PNR when her fuel begins to disappear too quickly. Vapor streams from under the left wing. At first, she is aware only of relief. Eddie will avoid the fate he most feared. Again it plunge. She remembers what she'd written. She watches the fuel drop and decides to be true to her word. She decides, and yet she flies on. Does she understand then that she wishes to live? This memory will remain oddly blank, resisting her attempts to dredge the truth from it. Later, she will conclude she'd had many contradictory wishes. To live, to die, to go back and live her life over and change everything, to live her life again and change nothing. She doesn't know how much time passes before she steals herself. She doesn't think, but pushes down on the yoke, dives. The engines cry out. The water rises up to meet her. When she had thought she was going to fly a Spitfire into the sea, Jamie, already dead, had told her not to. She'd listened then. She'd seen the end of the war because of it. She'd seen rubble and rivers and elephants on red dunes. She'd seen manta rays and the polar ice caps. She'd lain in bed with Caleb on Oahu, listening to the trade winds. No voice comes now. Nothing but the whining engines, the rush of wind. But she pulls up. The plane levels off not far above the waves. The great gliding birds, the huge winged albatrosses, carve the air. She doesn't belong among them. Up she goes, back into the sky. Her hands tremble. She pulls the charts onto her lap. The fuel gauge doesn't care that she has changed her mind. The needle still drops, Vapor still streams from the wing. She searches Eddie's pencil marks on the gridded blue paper for a secret passage back into life. First, she sees Macquarie Island, 20 miles long and oriented almost perfectly north-south. She knows there is a weather station there, manned year-round. But the island is well to the west, against the wind. She doesn't have the fuel. Farther north, but farther east, is another speck. Campbell Island. South still tugs at her compass. Empty ocean surrounds her. Finding the island would be difficult even if her navigation skills weren't so rusty. Maybe she will fail, but she will try. Of the next hours, she will remember capturing the sun and the sextant, scribbling calculations, churning with internal debates. The fear in her is smothered almost to nothing by the necessity of focus, of action. She will not remember how she comes to conclude that the plane itself must be lost, sacrificed, that she must try, if she can, to keep her survival a secret, that the only way she can contend with continued life is to make a new one. These decisions will become simple facts of her past, waypoints at which she turned, altering her destination. Any ambivalence she feels, any counter-arguments she makes to herself, will be lost, erased by the immutability of what has been done. When, under a high overcast, the island's silhouette breaks the horizon, she sheds her reindeer parka, gets into her parachute, and Mae West. The island grows steadily nearer. She braces the steering yoke as best she can. The plane only needs to be steady enough, and only for the few minutes she requires. When land is below, she goes to the back of the fuselage, heaves open the door, and jumps. She has never done a parachute jump. Pridefully, she'd told herself she'd landed planes when other pilots would have jumped. But now, plummeting through space, she thinks some practice would have been useful. She pulls the ripcord. With a violent jerk, the chute opens. The Peregrine flies on, oblivious to its new independence, the imminence of its watery end. A pang. She looks away. Between her feet sways a grassy, tussocked mountain. Here is a truth. She prefers to hide, to cease being Marion Graves entirely rather than face what she has done to Eddie. She no longer cares the circle is unfinished. That causes her no shame. But she believes she brings death to those around her. Before she left, she had gone to Seattle to meet Jamie's child. She had thought she would visit the girl from time to time after the flight, know her as she grew up. But now she is certain she would bring only misfortune. Let Adelaide be something else entirely. Let her not be a Graves. The wind pushes Marion out over a long and narrow inlet of black water. An albatross glides by with a whoosh, turning its head to inspect her. She had seen them nesting on the tussocked mountain as she descended. Enormous, blindingly white birds settled among the wind-blown grass like dollops of snow. Glossy black water between her boots still. She pulls on the parachute's handles, trying to steer, but the wind ushers her firmly out toward the mouth of the inlet, out to sea. Just off a rocky beach, not wanting to be blown farther from shore, she unclips her harness and drops. The cold of that water, the force of it. She makes her gannet plunge after all, but feet first. She sees blurry darkness, a silver ceiling. Stunned as a clubbed fish, she placidly watches the surface recede until she remembers she must pull the cords of her Mae West to inflate it. She will remember the air and waves, the heaviness of her boots and clothes, the numbing cold, the startling nearby porpoise leap of a small penguin out of the water. Surf crashes. Black ropes of kelp, long and fat as fire hoses, writhe in the surge as she is dashed on the rocks. She keeps only a jagged fragment of the event. A cascade of foam, a hard impact. Her Mae West is punctured, her face badly scraped, her nose broken. A last churning tumble, and finally there is coarse sand under her fingers. She drags herself from the water, permits herself to lie still for a moment in her sodden clothes before her chattering teeth tell her she must walk. Dense, brittle shrubs grab at her ankles. Mud sucks at her boots. She's been lucky with the tide. Later, when she has been on the island for a while and retraces this first walk, there will be no beach at all, only a cliff. She sits and rests many times, is stumbling and hypothermic when she reaches a hut marked by a radio mast and spinning anemometer, smoke rising from a chimney pipe. With the last of her strength, she knocks on the door.
A dive with intent. 21. When I got back to LA, before I had to film the crash, I took another flying lesson. This time, the instructor was a woman, a no-nonsense sort of gal in Wrangler jeans with a strict bob of orange hair and aviator shades. I took a lesson once before, I told her as she walked me around the plane, explaining its parts. But I freaked out when it was my turn to fly. "What do you mean freaked out?" she said. "I just didn't want to fly it. I let go of the controls, like this." I held up my hands as though someone were pointing a gun at me. "Do you want to fly it now?" "I might not," I said, "but I want to try." "Cool," she said. This time it was afternoon, and there was no marine layer, just open sky dingy with smog. Catalina wallowed offshore. The ocean horizon was soft and hazy. In every other direction, the city sprawled and sprawled. The jets sailing up from LAX, noses in the air, almost made me feel sorry for our plucky little Cessna. "Okay," said the pilot as we churned effortfully toward Malibu. "Go ahead and take the yoke. Just fly steady and level." In Hawaii, when I left Joey Kamaka's house, I'd gone back to my hotel and flopped flat on my face on my bed and cried. I cried because Marion Graves hadn't drowned and, to one person, hadn't been lost. I cried because of Joey's kindness, because I was jealous of Kehlani having a childhood, because I was the kind of asshole who could be jealous of a little kid whose parents couldn't take care of her. I cried for Mitch and for my parents. I cried because I'd gotten going, and sometimes you just have to ride out the tears. Beyond my balcony, beyond Waikiki Beach, out in the middle of the Pacific, the sun was easing down. Surfers dotted the water, sitting on their boards. Kids played in the shallows. In a movie, this would be the moment when I would rush outside and plunge cathartically into the sea. Newly whole, forever changed, I would float on my back, smiling beatifically at the sky. Since I didn't have any better ideas, I put on my bathing suit. I rode the mirrored elevator down to the Tiki Chic lobby and jogged outside in my flip-flops and labored through the perfect powdery sand. I dropped my hotel robe and walked into the water and dove under. Down there, eyes closed, rocking with the swell, I imagined the sand sloping away into darkness, into submerged deserts and canyons and mountain ranges, rising again into the edges of all the continents. I thought of ships and airplanes and bones being eaten away to nothing by rust and by tiny nibbling things grown over by coral and sponges, scuttled across by crabs. I thought of the peregrine and how no one would ever find it. No one would ever know where to look. When I surfaced, a wave lifted me, pushed me back toward shore. I swam out again. I'd forgotten, somehow, that the sun was fire, that it was molten, until I watched it waver and redden as it slid, almost oozed, behind the sea. The water dimmed. The clouds flushed. I didn't know what I would do after the movie was finished. It occurred to me that I could go to New Zealand or to Antarctica, keep playing detective, but no, I didn't need to know the whole story. No story is ever whole. When I'd looked up, sitting in the water grizzly, I'd read that he died after someone reached inside him and cut off a piece of his heart. But then his body didn't decay, as though without his whole heart he couldn't transform anymore, not even into dust. I hoped Marion had kept her whole heart. I put my hands on the yoke. The plastic was warm from the sun, and I could feel the vibration of the engine. The pilot showed which instruments to watch, showed me what was supposed to be the horizon and what was supposed to be the wings, how to line them up. "Doing okay?" she said. "I think so," I said. "If you pull back a little bit," she said, "the nose will go up." I pulled back. The windshield filled slowly with sky. Los Angeles, 2015. 22. When the plane hits the water, the sound cuts out except for a faint ringing. Before, there'd been wind and the engines and my amplified breathing. But then, at the moment of impact, it all goes away. Seen from a distance, a massive, silent splash in an empty sea. The plane rocks in the waves. The nose dips under. The rest slides after. The ocean seals itself shut. Huge white birds glide along the waves, and you hear that high, sustained ringing, quiet enough to seem half imagined. Then we're underwater, looking at me and Eddie in the cockpit. Bubbles rise from my nose. My cropped Marion hair wafts around my head. Eddie is unconscious, his forehead bloody. I lean forward, looking up at the receding surface, wistful but resolute. I close my eyes. Then, as though to give me privacy while I drown, we cut away to a shot of the peregrine from above, submerged, its shape sinking into blackness. I expect a fade to black, but instead, light seeps in through the dark, eats through it like mold, fills the screen. "That was Bart's idea," Redwood says, whispering even though we are the only ones in the screening room. "The white." Music fades in. The end credits start. Redwood's face is bright with reflected light. He points, "There!" His name is on the screen, and then it is gone. I don't watch for mine. "Ready?" I say, and we get up and push out through a side door into the blinding afternoon. It's not some big triumph that I didn't freak out when I flew the Cessna, that I made it go up and down, left and right. Mostly, I felt relief and a little hit of amazement. And then I must have slipped back into being Marion Graves because, for a second, I felt free.
The end. She's in the ocean now, as she was always meant to be. Most of her has come to rest, scattered on the cold southern seafloor. But some of her smallest, lightest fragments, floating dust, are still being carried along by the currents. Fish ate a few tiny motes of her, and a penguin ate one of those fish and regurgitated it to his chick, and some infinitesimal speck of her was back on Antarctica for a while, as guano on a nest of pebbles, until a storm washed her back out to sea. She dies twice. The second time, 46 years after the first. She dies in the Southern Ocean. She dies on a sheep farm in the Fiordland region of New Zealand. The man who opens the door to the hut on Campbell Island is called Harold, and he is, as he would say, being a practitioner of understatement, a bit surprised to find a sodden, semi-conscious woman at his feet. She is mumbling, jabbering. As best he can make out, she is begging him not to tell anyone she's there. "But who are you?" he asks, heaving her to her feet, bringing her inside. By then, she is past being able to respond. There is another man on the island, John, and a border collie called Swift. The hut and a few small outbuildings had been constructed during the war to house coast watchers, stationed there to alert the mainland if they saw enemy ships. They never did, but their meteorological observations proved so useful that after the war, the station was kept going. A year-long posting for a certain kind of man, a deliberate, meticulous kind of man who needed little society, who was content to perform the same tasks every day, take the same measurements, record the same data, translate that data to Morse code, and send it to some unseen recipient for use by people he will never meet, would prefer not to meet. It is one of the most significant waypoints of Marion's life that Harold and John are two such men. She spends several days in fevered delirium. When she first starts to regain her senses, she is afraid of the quiet, bearded figures she perceives around her. Thinks of what so many men, sequestered on a desolate island for months, would be likely to do with a woman. But Harold and John only ever touch her with unobtrusive concern. A hand on her forehead, a changing of the bandage on her face where the rocks had cut her. Support under her neck as she sips broth, and never leer or linger, even when they have to help her pee in a bucket beside the bed. Both have wives and children in Christchurch, but over time she comes to suspect they prefer the island, are content with their barometers and whirligigs and weather balloons. When she's regained some strength, she tells them a little bit of her story, and later all of it, because she thinks they'll be more likely to keep her secret if they can survey the entirety of its surrounding landscape, decide for themselves her right to it. The only thing she can't bear to tell them is that she left Eddie behind. She tells them her navigator fell into a crevasse, burns with shame instead of fever. They listen gravely without comment and retreat outside to talk between themselves. When they return, they tell her they had received, a week before she arrived, a radio alert to report any sighting of a C-47 Dakota, feared lost. They ask who will miss her. She says, "No one." Caleb would forgive the lie. She says she has no husband, no children, no parents, no brother. They tell her they will respect her wishes, not report her, but also that the ship that brought them will not return until January, nearly 10 months. She might change her mind before then. For now, they have no objection to her remaining. Shame again. She has invaded and disrupted their little colony of two, spoiled their peaceful year. She promises to make herself useful, and they nod, unconcerned. When she asks about food, they say there ought to be enough. Plus, if need be, there are seabirds and their eggs, some cabbages they are growing, and also sheep, left over from a failed experiment in which the government leased the island to farmers. She brings no hardship, they say. Do they think she is wrong to try to leave herself behind? They exchange inscrutable glances. Finally, Harold says, "We reckon it's your business." But, she asks, what about the ship when it comes? They will have to explain her. She will be found out, and all this trouble will be for nothing. They say that is something to be considered later. There is no hurry. In shape, Campbell Island resembles an oak leaf eaten away by insects. Its coast indented by inlets and bays and two long narrow harbors. Perseverance, into the mouth of which Marion splashed, and northeast. Its slopes appear gentle, but walking is hard going because of the tussock grass and the mud, and that dense shrub that John, the more botanically inclined of her companions, teaches her to call Dracophyllum longifolium. Besides the beards, as she thinks of Harold and John, and the dog Swift and herself, the island is occupied by sheep, rats, feral cats, sea lions, fur seals, elephant seals, the occasional leopard seal, a number of species of albatross, other seabirds and land birds, and two kinds of small penguins, the abundant rockhopper, which nests in the rocks, and the more secretive yellow-eyed, which nests in the bush and is usually glimpsed hurrying furtively up the beach. She wonders if Eddie could have changed his mind. If he had, he might hold out for quite a while, survive off the supplies in Little America and by hunting seals and penguins. She wonders if he might be hoping she will send help after all, if he had truly been so sure she would not make it. She wonders if he is already dead. She regrets the sadness she will cause Matilda and Caleb, and perhaps Jamie's Sarah, but she thinks they might as well grieve because she is gone. The male sea lions have left for the year, Harold tells her, but the females have gone inland to pup, and she often encounters the animals. They burst roaring from the brush where they have hidden their babies, or they belly toboggan down the hills on muddy trails bound for the sea. Harold is conducting a survey of the southern royal albatrosses, and Marion goes with him to count nests and chicks and to hold the massive birds in her arms, one hand wrapped firmly around the bill while he crimps identifying rings around their pinkish, leathery ankles. They tramp all over the island, even in the excoriating winter winds, recording in total 938 birds in Harold's ledger. The birds are ungainly on the ground, easy to catch. The adults are magnificently white with good-humored black button eyes, thick pink bills, wingspans as long as two men set end to end. When she first arrives, the birds are still sitting on their chicks, but gradually the young ones grow into hungry heaps of white fluff, substantial enough to be left alone while the parents go to sea to feed. After their feathers come in, the chicks stand up and stretch their wings in the breeze, and finally, around the time Marion leaves, the first ones fly away, making teetering experimental leaps into the wind. Harold says once fledged, they will not touch land for several years. They will fly around Antarctica, returning to Campbell from the opposite direction one day to breed. Marion's special purview becomes the sheep. Before the war, farming on the island had been given up as hopelessly unprofitable, and the sheep left behind to roam wild. They are hardy and wily, the ones who survived and bred, and she finds herself drawn to them. Swift, the dog, shares her interest in the sheep, And slowly, with many failures, the two begin to learn how to move them from place to place, just to see if they can. In one of the abandoned farm structures, she finds old shearing blades. She patches up a falling down corral, toils patiently with Swift for days before they actually manage to drive a single sheep into it. John had worked with sheep in his youth and offers suggestions in passing, mostly leaves her on her own. Shearing is hard work. She makes a hash of many a sheep before she gets the knack. There is no real reason to shear the incorrigibly wild Campbell sheep, but it has begun to dawn on her that she will need a skill other than flying airplanes if she is to become a new person. After she has been on the island 6 months, the Beards sit her down and say they might have a way to get her to the mainland undetected.
"We would have told you sooner," John says, "but begging your pardon, we weren't so sure about you at first."
Harold's brother, it turns out, is a keen yachtsman and has talked about sailing to Campbell for a visit in early summer, before the annual ship comes in January to bring fresh Beards and take away the old ones. She could, perhaps, if the brother is amenable, sail back with him. They hadn't wanted to ask him over the radio for lack of privacy, so they will have to wait and see what he thinks, if he comes at all. If he isn't amenable, or she isn't, well, then, they'll have another think.
"But you're still sure," Harold says, "that you don't want to be yourself anymore?"
She is sure, and the brother, who turns out to be even more taciturn than Harold, is amenable. And so, after much silent valedictory hand-gripping with the Beards, she leaves Campbell Island and reaches Invercargill at last in January 1951, under sail. After 10 months wearing clothes borrowed from the Beards, it seems natural to continue dressing as a man. She feels as she had as a teenager, skulking around Missoula in overalls, hat pulled low, though now her disguise is more convincing, with her broken nose and weathered skin, her rough hands and her shoulders sturdy from shearing. She goes north into the country around Mount Cook and gets a job as a high country shepherd. She keeps to herself, which is easy to do, living in a hut on the side of a mountain, tending to unruly, bleating masses of merinos. They aren't as skittish as the Campbell sheep, nor quite as hardy, but they are by no means docile. She gets better with sheepdogs, better at shearing, though she is never especially quick. She speaks little, doesn't complain, can hold her drink, and so is respected. From the Beards, she'd picked up a passable Kiwi accent that gradually becomes second nature. Any oddness, she explains away by saying truthfully that her mother had been American. Later, some people will claim they'd had suspicions about her sex, but at the time, none are voiced, not directly. Certainly, she takes some ribbing for her slightness. Twig, they call her in the shearing shed. But her broken nose and her pilot's squint and the scars on her face from frostbite and the rocky Campbell shore give her a tough look. She's never had much in the way of a chest, nothing a hard band of elastic and a couple layers of shirts can't hide. She calls herself Martin Wallace. She believes she deserves to be isolated and unknown, that loneliness is a fitting punishment, but time weakens her resolve. Her self-recriminations grow softer. She has been a shepherd for 3 years when a photo of her, face obscured by shadow, happens to appear in a Queenstown newspaper. And on impulse, she cuts it out and sends it to Caleb. "Sitting in the water grizzly," she writes, wondering if he will remember the story he'd once told her. She can't bring herself to write down the bald truth, prefers to leave things up to chance. She has, in some ways, begun to lose any rigid idea about what constitutes truth. She catches herself remembering Eddie falling into a crevasse, though it had not happened. Or perhaps it had, later, What she is really remembering is her own foot popping through the snow, being balanced between a white nothingness and a black one. Caleb comes to see her for Christmas in 1954, and an aperture is opened between her two lives. When she meets his ship in Auckland, it is her first trip to the city since she'd departed for Aitutaki with Eddie. And so the circle is finally closed, without fanfare, 5 years after she'd begun it. With Caleb for 2 weeks, she returns to her body. There is no question, as there never has been, of him staying, but there is equal certainty he will return. She'd told him in Hawaii that she envied how he'd found a place that quelled his restlessness. She had not thought she would ever find such a place for herself, but in New Zealand, she does. Perhaps her peace is inherent to the land, or perhaps she has simply exhausted herself. She longs to fly an airplane again, but she doesn't long to see over the horizon. And she feels she must make sacrifices in atonement for her survival, for leaving Eddie. She will not fly. She will not know Jamie's daughter. The presence of her own book on her shelves is a dark joke. She had never quite intended to write it. And yet, there it is, in its mustard dust jacket. If she had succeeded, if all had gone according to plan and they had landed triumphantly back in Auckland, she would never have let it be published as it was. She had left it behind in Antarctica as a gesture of defiance, a marker of her existence like a stone cairn. But then she had neither succeeded nor died. In the years before the logbook was found, she seldom thought of it. Then there it was in a newspaper photograph in 1958, in the gloved hands of an ice scientist doing research at Little America 3. She'd been shocked and frightened by the prospect of stirred-up publicity, of her photo being printed and reprinted, of everyone being reminded that Marion Graves had once existed. For years, she worried that someone might recognize her after all, but as it turned out, no one did. She was greatly changed. And also, she had settled in a corner of the world where people didn't pay much attention to things like lost American lady pilots. When the book was found, she had wondered if Eddie would be too. She'd wondered if there was any possibility at all he might still be alive after 8 years. Though surely, even if he'd managed to feed and warm himself, he would have been broken by the solitude, the extremity. The question was irrelevant, though. He hadn't wanted to survive. What were his last days like? How many of them had there been? Did he live until winter? Did he fall in a crevasse after all? His body wasn't inside Little America, or the scientists would have found it. If it had been her, she would have done what he said he would do. Walked in the winter night far away from camp and lain in the snow, under the stars and the aurora. Or maybe not. It is not lost on her she had twice failed to choose death. She'd written in her logbook that her life was her one possession. She had kept it. She had wanted it. In 1963, a crew of a Navy icebreaker will catch sight of buildings smushed like sandwich filling in the middle of a tabular iceberg drifting 300 miles from the Ross ice shelf. Little America 3, its bunks and Victrola and frozen dog turds and corn on the cob, all gone out to sea. Eddie, too, wherever he was, would eventually be calved into the Southern Ocean inside an iceberg, would sail north aboard his grand funeral barge, a pyre that would not burn but melt. He would end in the ocean after all. But he must have known that. Caleb comes to New Zealand a second time. They argue about money. He wants her to take all the royalties from the book. Finally, she convinces him to keep 40%. With her new fortune, moderate though it is, she is able to shift her identity once more. She goes away to the North Island for the better part of a year, becomes a woman again, calls herself Alice Root. What documents she needs, she gets from a forger in Auckland. When she is ready, she returns to the South Island, buys her farm, makes a go of it. She trains horses and sheepdogs. She hires the right hands. She is one of the first to use a helicopter for mustering. The land is rugged. The sheep find their way to places that would take full days to reach on foot, and allows herself the indulgence of learning to fly it. Early on, she occasionally encounters someone from her shepherding days, and usually they do not recognize her, or not confidently enough to ask. But to those who say she reminds them of a man called Martin Wallace, she admits, almost casually, that yes, she had been posing as a man for a time because she'd needed the work and wanted to learn the ropes of sheep farming. Some are outraged. Others, after brief astonishment, manage to admire her pluck. Gradually, word spreads through the sheep community and everyone knows. Though a few prudish souls refuse to do business with her and do their best to spread vituperative rumors, by then she is well established and independent enough to suffer no important ill consequences. There is a long history of women disguising themselves as men in order to be soldiers or sailors, even pirates. Who was to worry too much about one lonely shepherd? Lambs born, lambs sent to slaughter, sheep shorn, prices of wool. In the late 60s, adventure cruises to Campbell Island come on offer, and in 1974, she and Caleb go. As the ship enters Perseverance Harbor, she points out where she had been dashed against the rocks, where she had walked along the hillside before finding the beards. He sees the seals and the penguins. There are still sheep on the island then, though in the 80s the last of them will be culled, except for a handful brought to the mainland for genetic study. They are so very hardy, so tough. She and Caleb sit together in the tussock grass among tourists and anoraks and watch groups of young royal albatross preen and show off, wings spread, calling out with their pink bills pointing at the sky. It's called gamming, she tells Caleb, a word for when whaling ships used to pull alongside each other at sea for a chat. She is 60 years old. She shows Caleb the direction she had last seen the Peregrine flying, the horizon over which it had passed, and somewhere, unseen, crashed into the ocean. And so she returns to another beginning, closes another circle. She is pleased when she is old not to have a string of descendants to worry about. The world will do as it will without any of her blood. When she learns you can look people up on the internet, she looks up Adelaide Scott and discovers she is an artist. She thinks Jamie would have been pleased. Caleb comes for the last time when she is 75. A few years later, he writes to tell her that he is ill. He will not, he says, say goodbye. Her heart flutters in her chest sometimes. Her bones are brittle. Gravity seems greedier than before, eager to tip her to the ground. The final smash up. In her will, she includes a bequest to a woman, her farm manager, who has worked for her longer than anyone else. The farm manager has always wanted to go to Antarctica, and Marion will leave her money for a trip to the Ross Sea, along with a request that somewhere south of Campbell Island, she scatter Marion's ashes from the ship. Marion can imagine the plume of herself riding the westerly wind over the Southern Ocean, the bits of teeth and bone sinking at once, a gritty gray film settling on the surface until the chop mixes her in. But she doesn't know what will happen to the part of her that is not her body. All the times she has brushed against death, she's never given much thought to what might come after. Now she considers it. She supposes there will be nothing. She supposes each of us destroys the world. We close our eyes and snuff out all that has existed, all that will ever be. But if she could choose, she would ask for lift. She would want to rise from her body and have it be like when she'd first gone up with Trout, as though she were being held aloft by pure possibility, as though she were about to see everything.
This is Alex McKenna. We hope you have enjoyed this unabridged production of Great Circle by Maggie Shipstead. This program was directed by Joseph Grimm, executive producer Orly Moskowitz, edited by Bookmark. Text copyright 2021 by Maggie Shipstead. Production copyright 2021, Penguin Random House, LLC. All rights reserved.